Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, Episode 21, The State of 3D. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/theater. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. Today's guest geek of the week is Rick Dean, Senior Vice President at THX and Chairman of the 3D at Home Consortium. Hey, Rick, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Now, obviously, 3D is a huge deal these days, and you, I think, as the chairman of the 3D at Home Consortium, are right in the thick of it. Summarize the state of the industry for us, if you would.
Well, of course, we're at a really critical launch state right now. With Blu-ray supporting 3D, you can actually go to a store today and buy a display, 3D player, and even a 3D movie. Content is going to catch up with all this soon, and to include the ever important satellite, cable, and broadcast industries as well.
Now, we have displays, as you said, and Blu-ray players, but so far no content. What can we expect in terms of content? How much will be rolling out, and on what schedule?
Well, I think the schedule is always something that is strictly up to the studio. But the Blu-ray format will carry a lot of 3D movies, and I think you'll see a lot of them come out between now and the holiday season for this year.
Do you know how many, roughly? I've seen some numbers, but I can't recall them off the top of my head.
I don't know exactly the total number that is going to be supported. I know they're going to include many of the top movies that we've just seen leave the theaters right now. I think that other methods of 3D broadcast over cable and satellite, channels like ESPN has committed to, I think, over 47 events this year, which will help round out the content to not only be movie-centric, but also sports. You look at your pay TV movie channels, they'll be setting up pay-per-view 3D events. And I think so. The content will certainly be evolving over time.
What about online delivery? Can we expect to see 3D content from online? I know we've got bandwidth issues there, but maybe they figured that out.
Well, there's a lot of bandwidth issues with anything outside of Blu-ray. And that's why, you know, one of the focuses is on a good Blu-ray experience. Anytime you deliver a movie over cable, satellite, online, yes, there are bandwidth issues. And those are being addressed by including other formats of 3D, which are the frame-compatible formats, such as the side-by-side, over-under. Those will at least work in any environment currently that carries HD.
Hmm. Can you describe the side-by-side and over-under you just mentioned? What does that mean?
Well, sure. If you were to imagine your common HD video frame, take and split that in half. Left eye is on one side, right eye is on the other, and that's how it will carry and look on a standard display. The 3D display will know what to do about taking that left eye and right eye image, scaling them out to full frame, and then so you have a sequential presentation that will be viewable with glasses.
By sequential, you mean that the right eye and then the left eye are displayed not simultaneously, but sequentially?
Exactly. Imagine taking a movie 24 frames a second, doubling the frame rate so that you can accommodate a sequential left eye, right eye delivery. And that's basically how it will display on the screen. Shutter glasses will make sure that the left eye is blotted out or blocked at the time that the right eye image, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you do that, before I get to that, I was going to ask you also, why would one even consider over-under, which I assume is the same situation, except that you're splitting the screen and the right eye, say, is on the top and the left eye is on the bottom, or vice versa. Probably doesn't matter, but why would you even do over-under?
There are certain efficiencies based on the codec that you use, why one might be chosen over the other. An over-under retains more of the horizontal resolution. Side-by-side retains a lot more of the vertical resolution.
Sure, but that brings up the primary problem that I see with frame-compatible transmission, which is that you're losing half resolution, either horizontally or vertically. And can it really be called then 3D? Can it really be called high def at that point?
Yes. The definition of the image, if you look at the broadcast tests that have been done so far in these formats, the image is absolutely, stellar quality. However, over time, we'll see frame sequential delivery in markets as soon as the bandwidth gets up there. That's going to be the important thing, though, is that that's going to have to happen over time. In order for these other markets to launch a 3D service now, you have to work within the existing infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Is it a bad image? Is it a bad experience? Not at all.
And more than one content provider has told me that, yes, you have to divide the resolution in half, either horizontally or vertically. But then, as you said, once it gets into the TV, it is scaled up to full resolution. So there is some recovery of information, whether or not it's the actual information from the original signal or recreated by interpolation, which we're all very familiar with LCD TVs. They claim that they're actually recovering quite a bit of the resolution, and you're seeing more than only half resolution.
Absolutely, and I think that's one of the things that'll allow manufacturers to differentiate product, is to put some technologies in that decode step, so that these markets or these services will look good. A lot has been spoken about in that we'll one day evolve out of the frame compatible 3D formats. I really don't believe that that's going to be the case. We see a lot of bit constrained markets today, even in the HD world. We're going to continue seeing this. No matter how robust pipelines get to the home, we're always going to see bit rate constrained markets, and there'll be new deliverables that will always have to or always encompass efficiencies that frame-compatible 3D offers.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly in terms of broadcast, you have a very well-defined bandwidth for each channel, even in HD. I mean, you've got a bandwidth and you can divide it up different ways. You have, channel 7.1, 0.2, and so on. But there is an ultimate constraint there unless the whole infrastructure changes to allow a greater bandwidth. And then there's the issue of online, where that is dependent upon how much bandwidth you have coming into your home. In the United States, that's generally pretty low compared to some other places in the rest of the world. Like, for example, South Korea, typically you have 20 megabits or more coming into the home. Here in the U.S., it's more like 4 or 5.
if that, and I live in Southern California, and if I get two consistently, that's a big thing. So again, I really believe that there's every instance that frame compatible formats will continue to exist, and we're going to deal with them. What's great about this is the technologies that support all this right now can encode into a side by side or top bottom format. It can be delivered over existing infrastructure using the efficiencies that are there, and then be decoded in the display device and look absolutely spectacular.
This brings up then the issue that one of the issues that I see as being a bit problematic, and that is one of standards. We have a Blu-ray 3D standard, which I was actually a little surprised, that came out as easily as it did. But I think there are other places where things could be standardized that aren't. For example, the IR signal that syncs the active shutter glasses is different from one manufacturer to another. So you can't take your Panasonic glasses and go watch a Samsung TV, for example, 3D TV, for example. What's being done in terms of standardization?
Well, CEA and 3D at Home are working on just exactly that right now. That is vitally important. And you're right, there are no standards that exist today which define a shutter glasses and how they're supposed to work and how they interface with the display. So therefore, you're going to see more problems like this until we have standards that support a single spec where everyone can take and manufacture too. Mm-hmm. I think the standards, and it's just not, it's just not that by itself, but also standards all the way around. How does the interaction work? If you send a HD program to a display, and then you flip the channel and you send a 3D frame compatible program to that same display, how does that display know exactly the difference between one program, which is HD 2D, and HD 3D?
Well, excellent question.
Simply put, it doesn't. And that's where metadata is so vitally important, to make sure that we get that information along with the content, so the devices at the end of the chain know exactly what to do with that. Mm-hmm. Those standards are also being worked out right now. And we should have some results of that probably by the end of the year, if not sooner. A lot of companies like THX have solutions out there that we're pitching, and we think that they're very, very important. And it's just not, the complexity is just not about 3D either. Watching your video games, watching your Blu-ray movie, looking at your photographs, the display often doesn't know what it's looking at either. So all of these things require, for the optimized experience, all of these formats require some form of metadata to actually describe itself to these displays, to the AVRs, to the Blu-ray players, so that they all know exactly how to treat the content.
Clearly a vital thing to develop. And that leads me to wonder whether or not the introduction of 3D as a product category was perhaps a bit premature.
Well, it's not the first time we've done that. I think the same. Even though HD has been around for a long time, I think in many cases HD was a little bit premature too. I mean, I remember buying my HD compatible TV set years ago. That won't work on any of the HD standards that are out there today, for example.
Man.
So you ran into that too, didn't you?
Well, no, because actually I have the benefit of getting the latest and greatest in all the time. So my equipment actually cycles pretty quickly. So I haven't had to really deal with that on a personal level anyway. Yeah. you're right. 3D is not the only time that we've perhaps released something prematurely. Blu-ray might be another example. I mean, that suffered from a format war with HD DVD, of course, and that slowed things down quite a bit. But still, people get frustrated when things are released before their time. I mean, of course, early adopters, you know, love to get whatever's the newest and latest and greatest. But that leads me to my next question, actually, which is, what is your response, or 3D at Home Consortium's response, to the concerns about 3D? For example, having to wear glasses at all, the high cost of glasses, the potential for headache and eye strain, that sort of thing.
Well, you know, we've actually had 3D in theaters for a long enough time right now that we've learned a lot about where some of those dangers lie. And I think that as we progress the technology, as we refine the products that go into the home, you know, a lot of these issues are going to be looked at further. There's always a chance that one individual may have more problems with 3D than another. We know that that's the case. But going out and buying a 3D-enabled TV set today offers little risk, especially since that's a great 2D display as well. And the glasses don't have to be used until you watch a 3D program. So I think 3D in its rollout right now is going to appear more as special events, and people will get oriented into being able to watch it for a longer period of time. We've seen this historically from the responses that we've had in the theaters.
Clearly, the response in the theater has been pretty good, especially since Avatar, became the greatest money-making movie in history, as far as I know, under some metric or another. But then there was Clash of the Titans, which certainly was not as well received, primarily, at least in part, because it wasn't conceived in 3D.
Well, Alice in Wonderland wasn't either, and I think the response from the public has been pretty positive about that as well.
Yes.
I won't necessarily say that any 2D to 3D conversion is naturally going to be bad. If done well, we know that it can be just as good. Especially with the fact that a movie like Alice in Wonderland, the production techniques and the applications of the graphics used to create the movie are a natural ability to take and break those objects back out and bring dimension into that picture.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, it's a lot more about how your original content was created. Going back to a legacy movie made 20 years ago, I would think would be a lot more challenging to make a really good looking 3D out of that, as opposed to an Alice in Wonderland. So mm-hmm. therefore, I think again, the tools used to actually perform the service and create this new image will progress over time. I know that a lot of industry professionals out there are putting a lot of time to refine this process right now. Studios are looking to convert movies to 3D so that they have another life cycle to go through. And again, I think that's putting a lot of attention into how to do 2D to 3D conversions well.
Mm-hmm. Your point about it being more difficult to convert something from, say, 20 years ago is certainly something that Roger Ebert pointed out in his screed about it in Newsweek. I'm sure you must have seen that, which I just responded to, actually, in one of my blogs on ultimateavmag.com just today. I posted that. He's a pretty strong opponent of 3D, saying, you know, would Fargo be helped by 3D? Would Precious? Would Casablanca? Would you rather see that in 3D? My response basically is, well, no, because it wasn't conceived that way. You know, and we didn't have the technology then that we do now. And if we had, would the director want might have wanted to go 3D, perhaps. We don't know.
Yeah, and I think we went through the same discussions when we started to colorize movies years ago, too.
Yes, colorization. You
know, the fact that Miracle on 34th Street, first one that Fox did, I was involved with that project. And believe me, it was a very lengthy, very expensive thing. And did they ever really get the result from it? They, you know, Fox realized some additional revenue from that. But I think when you change an art form, you always have to carry the responsibility of anticipating what that art form was supposed to be. I agree with you in that not every movie probably has should be 3D. Mm-hmm. The way that the shots are captured, the lighting, everything else is done to create the perfect 2D experience for that time. So I think overall one has to be very careful about how they go about any type of conversion like that.
Yeah, clearly so. On the other hand, some movies, if could easily benefit from 3D. I mean, Avatar was conceived from the beginning to be in 3D. I think Alice in Wonderland did benefit. I saw it in 3D, and I thought it looked fabulous.
Yep. Yeah, I think you know, 3D has to be treated like as it should be, which is a additional tool in the filmmaker's toolbox. We've been putting dimension into sound with surround sound for many years now. Mm-hmm. One of the points that you brought up earlier about you know, a good quality 3D experience, bad quality 3D experience, you can overuse the 3D effect. and so as long as you're careful to use the 3D tools at your disposal to bring the viewer into your story and immerse them into that movie experience. Mm-hmm. That's truly what you want to deal with, and not take them through a technology demonstration, which is often in some productions very much the case. I don't want to go to a movie and see a technology. I want to go there to see a story, and I want the storyteller to communicate that to me based on the immersiveness of picture and the immersiveness of sound.
Right, exactly right. In fact, this whole thing kind of reminds me of the early days of surround music mixes. I mean, we all remember SACD and DVD audio. And in the early days of surround music mixes, it was all pretty gimmicky. They would put, you know, certain instruments in the back channels and it would all sound very kind of weird and not interesting. But later, as the engineers matured and matured in terms of their understanding and learned how to use this more effectively, I find surround music mixes to be wonderful. And I think that at least good ones. And I think that the same thing might well be happening with 3D. I mean, we have a lot of 3D movies with a lot of stuff coming out at you from the screen, you know, poking you in the eye. And I think that as we move along, as this technology matures and people learn how to use it, primarily, more effectively, then we're going to see it's not going to be seen as so gimmicky and so strange, but more involving.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. Surround sound, as you say, when it first came out, they were all looking at how they could take and put stuff in the back channels because now they have that, and they didn't before. Only to find out that the more you put in the back channels for a movie takes the viewer's attention away from the screen.
Mm.
Okay. Well, again, that's why I say for 3D to overuse those effects, you know, if they want to take you on a roller coaster ride, because that's actually part of the story, story that's being told, that's one thing. But just to have something poke you in the eye, like you say, you know, every five minutes, just to remind you that it's 3D. Well, you know what? That's probably not the most effective use of the technology.
Seriously, not. One of the points that Roger Ebert made in his article that I liked was, He pointed out that one of his favorite filmmakers, Werner Herzog, is filming the ancient cave paintings in France in 3D. And Herzog said that he was not going to put stuff in front of the screen. It was rather all going to be behind the screen. And I thought that was a great example of a more mature approach to 3D, because I think as things get farther out in front of the screen, the less realistic and the more distracting they look. Would you agree with that?
Well, and it's those effects that also cause people to become slightly ill. And
yes.
And that, of course, is not the movie-going experience or how you want to go and pay for a ticket and, you know, sit there in a chair and, you know, again, get poked in the eye and all that kind of stuff. That doesn't benefit the technology.
Mm-hmm.
That approach, which is to create the depth, take away the surface of the screen and actually have something that goes, you know, far deep in the room, that's the perfect 3D experience. I think that's what you'll find was used most often in some of the better 3D productions that we see now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. One of the interesting things, getting back to the difference between 3D at home and 3D in the commercial theater, one of the things I find interesting is that the TVs, the displays that have gone on sale so far anyway, for the most part, as far as I can tell, are not significantly more expensive than comparable 2D displays. And yet when you go to the theater, you're going to pay $3 to $5 more for a 3D ticket going into a theater with a digital projector that was there anyway and can show 2D just as well, for which they don't charge extra.
Interesting, isn't it?
Yes, it is. What is your response to this?
Well, I think the movie makers business models that exist, for any movie made for a large screen, there's nothing that beats a large screen, except when you get into some of the better flat panels that we see today, some of the projectors you can buy in the home that really brings that movie experience home. However, I think to a large degree, the manufacturers are making sure that the price points don't go that high of a premium for a 3D-enabled TV. And I think overall, what we're going to see is that the 3D display for the home doesn't necessarily mean a big growth in sales of flat panel displays as much as it is going to be just they'll infiltrate more of the 2D market. So there may be a time coming up in a year or 2 years from now where you won't be able to buy strictly a 2D television set moving forward. More and more of them are going to have 3D in there.
I'm amazed.
The higher price for the ticket sales in the theaters, you know, they make their choices with that, and God bless them. Maybe they use some better butter, you know, on the popcorn.
Yeah, well, this brings up my next question, actually, which is, it seems a bit odd to me that the studios are behind 3D at home. Because if I were a studio, I would want to make a commercial cinema experience that you couldn't get at home in order to get people out to the theater. And yet they are. Am I not right that the studios are as much behind 3D at home as the hardware manufacturers?
Oh, absolutely.
They're shooting themselves in the foot.
Well, not really. I think overall that they're trying to maximize, of course, the potential for a title. You go to the added expense to do a well done 3D production. It goes to the theater, and then it naturally should evolve into the home. It's a differentiation experience, and it's an artistic expression. If done right, it's an artistic expression. One more tool in that filmmaker's toolbox to really illustrate a premium quality.
Sure, but if you can get that premium quality at home shortly after the theatrical release, why go out to the movies? Why go to the commercial cinema?
Yeah, And it's still at it's about a 50-50 mix, cinema versus home entertainment. And I believe there's a place probably for both to exist.
I'm sorry, what do you mean by 50-50 mix?
Oh, as far as the revenues generated for a title.
And has that remained relatively constant over the last years?
Well, I think the theatrical event used to be the overwhelming revenue generator in the past. That's slowly been declining. Mm-hmm. And home video market has increased. Again, I think overall the offering of a 3D experience in the home helps bring a good potential of revenue source and a continued great experience. I mean, a filmmaker mm-hmm. knows right off the bat that the theatrical window for their movie is fairly short. How that
and
movie
get,
is
and getting
be
shorter.
Enjoyed and getting shorter. The way that the movie is going to be sustained in people's memory is going to be through home video.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I guess one of the other things that a commercial cinema can offer that 99.9% of home theaters cannot is the really big screen.
Really big screen, the social experience, all of these things are, you know, built into to that theatrical experience. Again, I think the maximum impact that you get out of a movie made for big screen is see it on a big screen.
Sure, sure. I actually happen to be one of those who appreciates the social experience. There are those plenty of people who complain about, oh, kid kicking the back of my chair. And I don't like that either, of course. Sticky floors and whatever. But there is something to be said for a communal experience, a large-scale communal experience that I find appealing.
Absolutely. Especially if you go into a very emotional story, having the people around you, I think, has been always part of what I remember as some of the better, more memorable experiences in the theater. Mm-hmm. But keep in mind that, you know, those theaters, since they've also had the ability to have a new electronic projector in there instead of a film projector, we're starting to see concerts, we're starting to see sporting events, we're starting to see a number of other types of productions that that also support that same communal experience and also helps fill those seats up as well.
Mm-hmm. The only way to get that large screen experience, not necessarily the social experience, although you could do that too, in the home would be with a projector. Now, I know that the initial offerings for 3D displays are all flat panels, plasmas and LCDs. I'm sure we'll see 3D projectors for the home. What's the latest on that?
Well, I think the DLP chip is, or any of the chip projectors some of them are capable of 3D. In fact, but overall, I think by the time this last season of new product hit the stores for 3D, mm-hmm. we already had about 2.5 million 3D capable TV sets in homes.
A lot of them mostly for Mitsubishi, I think, right? Rear projectors.
Well, yeah, rear pros, anything with a DLP chip in it, some plasmas are 3D. Again, I don't think they'll necessarily work with the new Blu-ray format, mm-hmm. but they certainly will work with the frame compatible formats. And a lot of the consumers who bought these products, frankly, didn't even know what they had.
Right. Actually, I believe Mitsubishi does have a little adapter box for Blu-ray. As you mentioned, their earlier sets were not built so that they would be compatible with the Blu-ray 3D spec, but I'm pretty sure they have a little box that you can buy that will take the output from a Blu-ray player, 3D output from a Blu-ray player, and convert it to the format that TV is able to display. So even those older ones are not lost.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's what the important thing is. That's the importance of standards and having at least a roadmap set up about how your technology is going to get launched to make sure that no one's left behind because they were an early adopter.
This is always of great concern. Another issue that we won't really get into here, but that has brought this up is the recent FCC ruling that allows movie producers or movie content providers to disable the analog outputs of cable boxes when showing first run movies in an early release window before the DVD comes out. And the people who bought TVs or HD TVs without HDMI, of which there are plenty, are going to be kind of left out in the cold on that particular issue for those particular titles.
Absolutely. That's been actually part of the game plan for a long time. Content protection, while, you know, if you term it as DRM, has not been a popular term, especially with the consumer. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the studios need to always take action to protect their assets, and their assets are those movies. And so, if this means that earlier window of content getting into the home, I think the consumer might like that.
At least those who have HDMI on their TVs.
True.
The ones who are really going to be hurting in this, I think, are the commercial cinema operators, because if people can get first run movies earlier in their homes, they're not going to want to go out to the movies as much as they might have in the past. It's less expensive. I mean, you know, a VOD video on demand title might be, even if it's $10 or $20, that's a lot less than you'd pay for tickets for a family of four.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the theatrical market has seen the trends, knows what's going on. That's why many of them are turning into more complete entertainment complexes, and just not just movie centric, but to dive into a lot of other types of entertainment so that a family can go there, spend a lot of time, be entertained, maybe have a nice meal. I mean, these types of theaters are popping up around the world right now.
Right.
And actually doing quite well.
Yeah. And as we said earlier, you know, you still can't get the really big screen experience or the social experience at home like you would at the movies.
Exactly. I think that will continue to go, you know, beyond just the movie experience and get into sports as well. I mean, you know, why do people go to a stadium rather than watch it from TV? You know, I mean, I haven't seen a tremendous dip in ticket sales at a football game or a NASCAR race just because it was broadcast local on TV as well. There's still that element of being there, being with people, sharing the experience with others. Not always the same experience that you can get at home.
Yeah, exactly. Well, before we continue, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, Audible.com, which is a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For listeners of Home Theater Geeks, Audible is being very generous, offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook you might consider trying is The Moment of Psycho, How Alfred Hitchcock Taught America to Love Murder by David Thompson. I know that there's plenty of shows now about murder, and maybe it all started with Alfred Hitchcock. This book would be a good place to start looking into that. To download this audiobook or another one of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/theater. That's audiblepodcast.com/theater. All right, getting back to Rick Dean from THX, let's turn now to THX, since that's the other hat you wear. What is THX doing in terms of 3D standardization or anything along these lines in terms of what technologies are you developing?
Well, as far as working within the industry, THX has been involved with working with the standards committees. As you mentioned, I chair the 3D at Home Consortium, which is a very important link between standards committees and manufacturers and studios. 3D at Home is really tasked with going out there and generating information so that the standards can actually be created a little bit quicker. And I think that we've done an abundance of work to help with that. Another hat that I wear is also I'm a governor of the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers. This has, in fact, I co-chaired the first 3D task force with that group year and a half ago, almost now. Where we dove into the requirements of how content goes from the post-production facility and actually gets into the other markets, and the creative use of metadata. So we've been working with the standards groups in helping to evolve specifications and generate information to do so. THX has had great success with our display program, of course, which needs to, which will be evolving into a 3D element of that program as well.
Now, I want to mention that we're talking about the display certification program, right?
That's true. Yes.
So, right. Certain TVs are submitted to THX, and you subject them to a wide variety of tests and make sure that they meet certain performance criteria, and then they can be
absolutely
called THX certified. And so you're obviously probably working on certifying 3D performance as well.
Absolutely. And where does that come from? I think a lot of people still have looked at THX over the years, maybe seen them as a audio-centric company. I've been working with the company for 11 years now, and my background is actually motion picture image mastering. When I worked for 20th Century Fox in the past, Deluxe Labs and others that are out there actually creating the images. What I brought in is the fact that if we certify a display today, what's the parameters that we deal with? It's just not the light level. It's not anything else. I'm bringing in a lot of the things that are necessary to qualify that panel based on what I've known about motion picture creation. And so carrying that forward into the performance of flat panel displays today, that's what that certification program is really all about. Mm-hmm. So it has its traces back into that. 3D, the same thing. I can tell you there's no standard set right now for how a 3D production is actually monitored, QC'd. These are issues that we're dealing with right now, helping the industry to nail down a proper environment to create 3D around. Also, what has to happen as that image goes from post-production, gets changed into deliverable formats, and then arrives in the home, and then what does that display have to do to make sure that it renders that image out the best way it can?
Mm-hmm. One of the issues that I see as particularly problematic is testing and measuring of 3D displays. I mean, we know, for example, that when you're watching 3D with the glasses on, the glasses cut a lot of light, especially the active shutter glasses, which are being used in most home flat panels at this point. We know how to calibrate and measure TVs in 2D, but not in 3D. For example, we need 3D test patterns in order to set the black level and the white level and measure the grayscale and do the calibration and all that kind of stuff. And in the review that I did of the Samsung TV, we actually held the glasses over the lens of the meter in order to find out what the actual light levels were and the color color points were and all that sort of thing. Well, what's going on in developing a standard for measurement and calibration?
Well, you just uncovered some of our secret right there. But in the cinema for a 3D production, the color corrector, the guy that's sitting there making tweaks on the picture, making sure that that picture is the image that the director wants to bring forward, they wear glasses. So therefore, really? if you take them off, you'll notice that the screen's a lot brighter, right?
Right.
But so it's critical that in these environments that you're going to be judging the picture the same way the consumer will in the home. Now, this is not a new fundamental. It's a way we've always done even 2D productions.
Mm-hmm.
However, 3D glasses, making sure that they operate the right way. What's the qualification of the display to represent the widest deliverable that's going to go into the home? These are all things that we're working on right now to standardize on. I think the industry is doing a good job right now without the standards, because there's a lot of smart people out there that have been in this game for a long time, and they know what to watch out for. We've been through this, you know, in many iterations of 2D in the past. But you're right. When those glasses are put on, what does that display have to do in order to offset anything that it was doing in the 2D world to make it right for 3D? And is it the display that has to change, or is the content actually going to get mastered differently?
That's a good question, because certainly other than the brightness factor, which is significant, in some cases, the glasses actually distort the color. They actually are color filters to some degree.
Absolutely.
And so how does the set compensate for that to get you back to the color gamut, the range of colors that the movie was mastered to, was created in? I look forward to that. Are you guys developing 3D test patterns? I really look forward to that.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, we're using them now. One of the things that we're doing is conducting some tests for the industry on the effect of color density and chroma shifts. Mm-hmm. So exactly to those points. Again, what's the standard for glasses? There are none. So therefore,
there are none.
If we can, you know, it'd be vitally important for us to standardize on what the ND value of the glasses are, and also if there have to be color shifts, what are those, so that we can account for them. Mm-hmm. Or can we neutralize them, or were these created by individuals who just really didn't, you know, think about these things? Standards for these things sometimes, take a little bit longer than one would wish, mainly because, believe it or not, companies have their own agendas out there. And so,
fancy that.
You know, you get a bunch of people, competitive companies in a room, and start to talk. In general, they all agree on the concept. They all want a good experience for their products. They all want a good experience for the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
But to come up with one single idea that works all around, that everyone can jump onto, rarely happens. Again, I go back to HD. You know, we as a production community were frustrated that we had MTSC and PAL to deliver on. So we said, well, we'll make HD universal. Well, now we have 18 different flavors of HD. So, you know, there's things that on the surface may start to look more complex. There's usually technological advantages for having various types of formats involved. Again, I go back to the fact that if we didn't have frame compatible 3D formats, we would only see 3D on a Blu-ray disc. Which is a great experience, hands down, wonderful. But again, it wouldn't necessarily bring 3D forward if we didn't have the all-important sports, broadcast television, pay-per-view movies, all the other things that we're used to doing in the 2D world. If we didn't support those, we wouldn't be able to have 3D proliferated out the market.
Speaking of test patterns, reminds me of another THX technology that doesn't get much coverage, and I think it's really, really important. And if I'm not mistaken, you created it, which is called THX Optimizer.
That came, again, from post-production. If you play back any program material off its master tape, you would set up that machine's output to head bars and tone. Audio levels, video levels, everything would be calibrated, adjusted on your scope, and therefore you know if you played back that material correctly, the program material that followed on the tape would also be rendered out correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Base fundamental. For Optimizer, what that really entails, which again we didn't go through maybe as much description on that as we could have, but the Optimizer patterns that you'll find on a disc actually went through the same steps of post-production, compression, the same settings as the movie content.
As the movie content on that disc.
As the movie content on that disc. So therefore, we make sure that those patterns, they need to play back perfectly. Peak white has to be where peak white should be. The color red needs to be exactly where color red needs to be, the color blue, so on. Black levels need to be maintained perfectly. If those test patterns play back on test equipment, then we know that the movie content has not been changed. And that's the base fundamental about THX and what it means on a disc is that we make sure that the processes that are employed to put the movie on that disc do not change the qualities of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then so what we do then is we simply put the test patterns up with simple menus and allow the consumer to use those same patterns to set their display up and be able to render out the content. That's how we make sure that not only the content's done correctly, but the consumer gets some value in calibrating their sets also.
Right. Well, we should make sure that it, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I just want to say that unless those patterns play back perfectly to industry standards, that movie is not passed. So therefore, what you're able to see is every movie with Optimizer applied plays back consistently. Will also play back consistent as it should to any industry standards that have been put out there as well.
Right. We should make sure that everybody understands that what Optimizer is a series of test patterns, essentially, very simple test patterns that are included on all THX certified titles, discs. And you can get to them through the discs menu and use them to set your brightness, your contrast, your color tint on your TV, which is essentially what we might call a basic setup. I don't generally call it a calibration because that's a little more complicated, but a basic setup that gets your TV into the settings that will reproduce the content as the content provider intended. And that's really the bottom line goal of THX and everything you guys do, right? Is to make sure that what was created gets displayed in a consistent and an accurate way.
Sure. Early in my career, I was the guy that sat with the director and we would go through and make sure that the adjustments made to picture, the color level, everything about the presentation of that image was done to the director's eye. Because the choice of colors, the choice of depth of contrast, everything leads to the emotional impact of a story. And so therefore it's vitally important that again, all of these settings evoke more emotion and everything related to that content just as much as sound does. So therefore, it is vital that that it be seen the way it was intended. And you're right. This is what George Lucas put THX on the map to do anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The most recent disc that is THX certified, I understand, is Avatar.
Yes, and unfortunately, Avatar, in the way that that disc was actually created, the high bit rates on Blu-ray, everything else, Optimizer didn't make it on there. But we'll be looking at that in the future.
Yeah, I hope I know. So.
It was disappointing to us too. But there was a lot of other content that didn't make it on the disc either. So we felt it better to go ahead and make sure the disc was just done as best as it could, working very closely with Fox and our partners Blue Focus. It really is a stellar product, and we're very proud of the way it came out.
Does that really max out the bitrate coming from a Blu-ray?
That was done at a maximum bitrate. It's a fairly vanilla disc. You might notice there's not a whole lot of other content on that disc.
Yeah, not a lot of bonus features.
And so, yeah, exactly. So all the bandwidth was really used for the best presentation of the movie possible.
Yeah, that's cool. Now, one of the most impressive or interesting things about Optimizer recently that I was very, very pleased to hear was that it is now available in the TiVo. I think the Premiere, otherwise known as Series 4.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's part of the TiVo. You can use it at any point in time to make sure that the TiVo output of that device works well with the display. It's a unique set of patterns that we found really useful. The Premiere XL product.
Right. What's so great about it to me? What's so great about it to me is that you can use Optimizer from a disc or even another test disc like Joe Kane's Digital Video Essentials or Spears and Munsell HD Benchmark to set up your TV for the disc player, but there's no way to set up the TV's user picture controls from a broadcast source like a TiVo or a cable box or something like that. So I was just so grateful to see such patterns in a broadcast type device that would allow you to set up your TV to optimize it using the word name of the product for that particular source. Because as we know, different sources might need to be, the TV might need to be set up differently for different sources.
Yep. And one of the things that we were able to do with the TiVo also is the fact that the glasses actually were packaged with that box so that the user would be able to set up color and tint, which is
the blue filter color glasses.
Right. So those are packaged with the device so that it can actually be used that way. The same gel glasses would be used for any of the optical discs as well. So, there you go. It's a complete system.
What's your opinion, though, of the problem with using these blue filter gel glasses on particularly LCD displays, which they are not particularly accurate, don't give you an accurate result? How do you deal with that?
Well, there's actually not a tremendous difference if you were to take and deal with one type of screen versus the other. We're not ever claiming, as you stated earlier, this is not a full scale calibration. This is a optimization. This is something to get you into that mid 90% range of being accurate. And I believe that the glasses we provide work on a very wide range of display technologies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You alluded earlier to the increasing complexity of home theater, which is certainly true. And one of the things that's most recent coming out of THX that I'm very interested in, that you've been working on for a long time, is called Media Director. which is you've just recently started to show people. You were at the cable show, I believe, not you personally, maybe, but somebody from THX was there demonstrating Media Director. Why don't you fill us in on that a little bit?
Sure. What Media Director is the kind of serves as the same intent as Optimizer. We've gotten quite complex with the various types of content that we feed into that display in our homes. The display itself has a fairly long list of features that you can choose. Selectable menus for different color spaces, video processing, aspect ratios, name it. There's a bunch of adjustments on there. Bottom line, what is the best way to watch a Blu-ray movie? What is the best way to watch Oprah Winfrey in the afternoon? What is the best setting to optimize a gaming experience? These are usually fairly basic controls that, as long as the content coming into that display can carry a small amount of metadata, we can optimize that display automatically without you having to pick up the remote control. And we think this is a very, very important thing because we also know that in a lot of homes, these settings are not exercised. So therefore, they're usually optimized to the best way that a 14-year-old left it when they were playing their Xbox or PlayStation game. And you know, the rest of the content going into the display just doesn't look right. But how do you get it right? And that's the confusing thing. We want to let the content go into the display and optimize the display. We want to make the display smarter. We want to make the content smarter so that they actually work together. That's the essence of Media Director. AVR, the same thing. There's 60 different ways to play back an average soundtrack on a $500 AVR. It gets more expensive or more extensive the more expensive the product is. Mm-hmm. Again, Media Director accommodates both for audio and video in the products that are enabled. And we have the, as you mentioned, cable show last week in LA. We were using the program to actually switch between the menu options of a set-top box, which was 2D, and going back to a 3D program. Media Director was providing the switching to automatically switch the display back and forth between 2D and 3D in the right mode using HDMI 1.4. But we also do a lot more than that. We can go from the color balance required to properly play back a game. We can go to make sure that if you play back the Star Wars DVDs, make sure that noise reduction is scaled all the way down so when the camera tends to pan on a star field that the display's noise reduction doesn't remove all the stars. That makes a guy like George Lucas very happy because he put all those stars there for some reason. So these are all very important things to be able to optimize the user experience, give them a lean back experience, and not have to go through what is starting to look like more like a science project to optimize your products every time you watch something on your system.
And having to go in and change those settings when you move from a movie to a game or to a broadcast program or whatever. This sounds an awful lot like what you were talking about earlier in terms of telling the TV what to do to go from 2D to 3D, for example, and so on. Is this part of Media Director? Is the actual 3D settings?
There are open standards that will allow that to happen over an HDMI 1.4. Mm-hmm. We just feel that that by itself is not enough when all these other problems exist in 2D space right now. And of course, the big question is if you go into a 3D 3D viewing experience, what color or white point is actually being, you know, where was your color set before? Is it movie mode or sports mode? Are all these things being adjusted? Again, standards don't address these things. THX's history in going in and making sure the content is created correctly to a standard means that we should all also be able to implement that same standard in a display and be able to switch that display automatically so that the user is not challenged with what button to hit at the right time. Mm-hmm. And we think that this helps preserve the entertainment experience and not add frustration to it.
So the content needs to have metadata formatted in a certain way. The player needs to be right. able to send it. The player or source box, a cable box, whatever, needs to be able to send it to the display. The display needs to be able to take that metadata, understand it, and set itself accordingly. Are there any such products mm-hmm. in which it's implemented currently, or when can we expect to see them?
We have product in our lab right now that has it running on it. What we found is that this is expected to be a simple firmware update to existing product to actually implement MediaDirector. To add it to a Blu-ray disc, it's a few hours extra spent in the production run of that disc to contain the metadata necessary for it. So therefore, content can be enabled very easily, and products that are in manufacture right now could also be implemented very easily as well.
Good.
So it's not... To answer your question it's not in product right now. You can't go to a store and buy this, but we hope to change that very shortly.
Do you have any sense of the timing of the rollout? Sometime this year, sometime next year?
Optimistically, it's probably going to be next year.
Mm-hmm. But as you say, if it's a fairly simple firmware update, then even existing product could be upgraded to include it.
Even the set-top box, and this is what we were showing at the cable show last week, is that set-top box had MediaDirector enabled in that device. And this is something that could happen in homes with the products that are in the homes right now. These devices are always getting firmware updates, and MediaDirector could be part of that.
Mm-hmm. Can you reveal any manufacturers who are planning to implement it?
I can't divulge that until they're ready.
Understood. Well, one last point then before we go. I know that you wanted to talk a moment about stereographic photography as another application of 3D technology, which very few people are talking about.
Yeah, and it's been out there for a long time. We've had, in fact, I think my parents' wedding was photographed in stereographic pictures. So
no kidding.
They showed me
wow.
the lenticular pictures from years ago. this is an art form again that I see Fuji, Panasonic, Sony, all the main manufacturers out there coming out with product right now.
You're talking about stereographic cameras, right?
Stereographic cameras, yeah. And really what we call 3D, for movies and all that kind of stuff, is really stereographic imagery. The name 3D kind of caught on, and so I think that name just kind of stuck. But it's hard to differentiate 3D graphics from 3D stereographics. Those two things are very different.
Elaborate a bit, would you?
Yeah, I think the 3D graphics is what we have on computers now, where we can take an object and basically turn it around and see the different perspectives and the depth that exists with there. It's not necessarily a 3D image.
It's still on a 2D display, though, right?
Exactly. As opposed to the 3D, where you have to wear glasses and everything else to make it work.
Right.
But I see these products are coming out right now, and I see just as much enthusiasm, frankly, from the consumers to go out and buy these 3D stereographic cameras to shoot little Sally's birthday party and have pictures printed. I think that the displays that are out there that we're buying right now also need to include a way to display those products or that technology. Mm-hmm. Not easy to find right now. So that's part of what's going to get worked into our THX spec is to also include that. I think it's going to be a huge market, actually.
Hmm. Well, it certainly sounds fascinating to me as an amateur photographer. I know I'm quite interested in playing around with that myself. And I do know that there are some what are called 3D clubs around the country. Don Munsell of Spears and Munsell is, in fact, heavily involved in this hobby as well.
You know, I spoke at a conference in Monterey last, I think it was in October. SixSight put that on. And I was surrounded around a whole stereographic community. These guys were still, I mean, they had their own built-up viewers and everything else, mainly because they don't have any other choice. I think these displays are perfect technologies for them to be able to use in the future. And these guys are reemerging right now, big time in the pro space. I think their markets are going to be more commercialized for a while, but I think the home is going to really get involved with this in the future.
And I look forward to it very much. Rick Dean, thank you so much for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Be sure to check out THX's website at thx.com and also 3D at Home Consortium. Their site is 3dathome.org, and that's at spelled out. My online homes are ultimateavmag.com and hometheatermag.com. And you can email me with questions or suggestions for future podcast guests at scott@twit.tv. And you can also follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be John Iverson, a recording musician and the web monkey for Source Interlink, publisher of my websites, and in fact, my boss. So I've got to be on my best behavior. We'll be talking about music servers and plenty of other audio topics. So until then, geek out.